But it is one of the most exciting things, in my opinion, going on in terms of social mobility.
It's about helping young people from low-income backgrounds, veterans and ex-offenders really create opportunities.
To make society fairer, more meritocratic, rather than one organisation shouldering the burden of delivering work experience, it's about bringing different organisations to subdivide that.
And the way of achieving it is unique and really starting to use everything that digital has to offer us, the Positive Transformation Initiative. Hello and welcome to yet another edition of the Ludic Insights podcast. This series explores themes and topics relating to all things digital and digital's impact on our societies, leadership and ways of getting things done. My name is Garrick Jones. I'm one of the founders of the Ludic Group and co-author of the book Alive Digital Humans and Their Organizations, available on Amazon, Kindle and at all good bookshops near you. This edition is focused on the Positive Transformation Initiative. May I say how pleased personally I am to have our two guests with us, Dan Brown and Barry Matthews, who I know from the Positive Transformation Initiative. As always, I'm joined by Paul Ashcroft, my co-author and business partner.
Hello.
Well, why don't we get straight into it? What is the Positive Transformation Initiative?
Garrick, yeah, thank you very much. It's an idea that really just came out of spending a long time, you know, working with a lot of companies, talking to charities and having, I suppose, what you'd look at as some well-meaning individual projects. And the idea really was to look at what's happening in the UK, feels that there's probably a need for greater collaboration between businesses, third sector and government, and look at ways that we can help existing initiatives, you know, kind of communicate better, collaborate and widen the impact of what they're doing by helping them get better access to resources and funding.
Does the Positive Transformation Initiative have a mission, a purpose? What's it trying to achieve?
It's really about aiding, you know, social mobility across the UK. I mean, hopefully the whole point of this is to widen that out. But initially, it's about helping young people from low-income backgrounds, veterans and ex-offenders really create opportunities, you know, for helping them create opportunities to become, you know, successful and access, you know, the right opportunities.
Barry, you're part of the Positive Transformation Initiative, been there right from the beginning, but you're also the CEO of the Social Mobility Business Partnership. How does it work, the relationship between those organisations?
Thank you, Garrick, and thank you for inviting us today, Paul and Garrick. How it fits in is that the charity I founded in 2018 was based on this concept of partnership and collaboration, and that no one organisation owns the issue of social mobility. And so having being invited to Dan's launch dinner in January of this year, it dawned upon me that what Dan was trying to achieve was the macro version of what I was trying to achieve in relation to students from low-income backgrounds, which was to make society fairer, more meritocratic, through enabling organisations to better collaborate. So, for example, with the SMBP, the way in which it works is that rather than one organisation shouldering the burden of delivering work experience, it's about bringing different organisations to subdivide that responsibility to make the step on point much easier. So we have four organisations in a cluster, each providing a day's worth of content, business-focused games for the students, and then the fifth day as a professional sports club learning about resilience. And the beauty of that is that when we've been recruiting organisations to the partnership, the simple sell is it's the cost of some sandwiches for 30 students and the time it takes to curate some content for the day. And beyond that, we will do the rest. We will find the students in the first instance. We will pay the travel expenses of those students. And then we'll provide the aftercare through a coaching platform. And we can only do all of this because the 130 or so organisations involved consist of 600 volunteers in aggregate, and those volunteers make the difference. And the beauty of it all is that it is a true partnership. No one organisation lays claim to it, and we're looking to create this baton pass mentality in addressing the issue of social mobility. And that's what drew me towards PTI, because PTI is all about expanding upon that principle and taking it to other groups beyond young people from disadvantaged backgrounds, to looking at reintegration as a wider concept when it comes to those coming out the forces and equally those who are coming out of prison. And ultimately, for all of us, this is very important for the fabric of society in terms of ensuring these people are properly integrated and people feel that society's fair.
That's amazing. I have been unbelievably impressed by how fast this initiative is scaling.
Certainly going fast.
It's astonishing. But there's something about how you're doing it, Dan. There's something about... It's not trying to start from scratch. You're standing on the shoulders of giants. You're acknowledging vast numbers of small groups around the entire country who are already doing this work and who will benefit from sharing knowledge, being together, and the resources that are available to a much larger representation. And you're bringing them together using digital means. I mean, that is, I mean, it's not rocket science, but it just makes sense. How did you get to this point?
I'm glad it's not rocket science, because otherwise I wouldn't be doing it. Ultimately, it's quite a simple concept, but it's something that, you know, my career, I was spending sales, I did a lot of, you know, connecting the dots. And it always served, you know, a great purpose to me. And it was just when I wanted to do something that was a bit more, you know, had a lot more of a social impact. It just, you know, what do you do well? Well, you connect people together. You know, how can you be effective? Well, I've got a really good network of individuals. Obviously, you know, people like yourselves who have been incredibly supportive, and Barry, and been very lucky, you know, to have people like, you know, Sir Kenneth Alissa, who's helped us and is becoming the executive chairman for PTI.
Sir Kenneth is the Lord Lieutenant of the Queen's...
Lord Lieutenant of the Queen in Greater London.
There we go.
Yes. And he has a...
And he's, you know, a patron?
He will be a chairman, yeah. And he's also just has an amazing backstory. And I think that's been, you talk about the speed of why this is happening. You know, the concept is there. But I think it's something that people are really getting involved with, because we're not asking anyone to support like another charity. What we're saying is we're creating an entity that's going to help support everyone's own charities and initiatives.
So it's enabling the other work of other people.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Gathering a lot of steam very quickly. And it's also opening up a real window onto stories that people have. You know, Barry has got a, you know, you look at people's backstories, people that you think, you know, would have come from, you know, certain backgrounds in terms of education or profession. But ultimately, it's really opening up a lot of windows to where people, what people's stories really are.
It's a big field, or a big space to work in. Where is PTI focusing in particular?
I keep getting told not to boil the ocean by Mr. Matthews here, but and it's right. You know, I suppose my biggest challenge is that I, you know, have an ideal and potentially would be trying to boil the ocean. It's been great working with Barry to be able to condense that down and say, right, what we need to be able to do is look at some identifiable, practical measures over the first 12 months. And because of the SMBP, where we've got, you know, a defined group of, you know, young people from low-income backgrounds that fits very well into my own background, so that's an obvious place to start. And also looking at working with some of the people who have been involved in projects that I've done personally before. You know, so veterans ties into homelessness, and, you know, working with ex-offenders, just to be completely frank, if it hadn't have been for a couple of individuals, I probably would have been in prison myself. I think it's important to identify, you know, the contribution those people made to my life and now be able to help, you know, in that. So those three groups are a good place to start.
Is it fair to say it's a network of networks?
Yeah, that's absolutely what it is. It's entirely... about, you know, people opening up their networks and widening impact through connecting the dots. You know, my role is to bring resources into that and also funding into that. But all of that is going to happen through people having a collaborative approach to networking.
I think that's one of the, as Barry's going to ask you, because one of the mantras or things I've heard as being part of this is, yes, money is important, but actually people can bring a lot more than just money into this sort of work. In particular, large businesses. I know you've been in conversation with many large organisations about how they can play a part in this.
Sure. I think, you know, I've been asked what's my elevator pitch on PTI, and I think for me it's a It's a social purpose VC fund which provides primarily resource. So we've got access to, you know, 100 or so top level CTOs who range from organizations in the Magic Circle law firms right through to the Prince's Trust and other organizations beyond within the FTSE 250. Equally, we've got access to a range of individuals who have management consultancy experience. And so we can go into charities, or actually more importantly, social issues that affect the three groups that Dan mentioned, and do what we do best in business, is look to see what's the optimal delivery model for solving the problems that these people face, but utilising the skills that we use in our day-to-day lives when we're working for major corporates. And for me, that's the most attractive thing about PTI, is that, you know, I've always said for a long time, the third sector doesn't necessarily need to be inefficient. It's just a case of applying the same business principles as you'd apply in a FTSE 100, say like at ITV, as I do in terms of the operational views I conduct there. So where Dan's come at it, he's got a huge contact book and a huge number of people who've got a huge amount of goodwill wanting to do something. And PTI is providing a structure for them to channel
it in. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of activity. What are some of the highlights of things that have happened so far?
Just to pick up on the point Barry made about the resources, a big part of this is a central resources platform. So talking to organisations about, you know, put the things they have available to their employees, training, skills, time, resources, and putting that into a central place. And so a big part of that is, frankly, you know, yourselves, Paul and Garrick, being able to work with us, you know, to support us in the providing a technology platform, you know, digital platform that we can start to work on to provide the infrastructure to do these things. It's all well and good coming up with an idea and having a, you know, a vision for something. It's quite something else to implement it. So working with you, that's been great. Yeah, we've got a number of projects that we're working around, you know, prisons and reoffending. We've got some entry to work research programs that are very, very practical in their outcomes. You know, the building of the digital resources piece, the building and creation of all of the online resources and media. We've already run several events to help bring a really inclusive group of people together, young people, veterans, ex-offenders, business people at all levels.
I think one of the things I'd add to that is that the level of complexity of the collaborations that Dan's bringing together, which haven't been done before because a lot of these organisations have been passing ships in the night. So we've got one project, as Dan said, around reoffending, which brings together between 4 and 5 different charities, all focused on the same thing, which is reducing recidivism, but doing it in a different way. So bringing them together in itself, in terms of actually identifying a joined-up solution, requires a place where we can fuse those ideas and also keep track of them. So that's why Smart Lab's been so bloody brilliant, in all honesty, because we need to ensure that everybody understands what the common narrative is, but accepting the complexity of different strands coming together and being able to easily dissect who does what and when, in the same way as we'd be planning any kind of project management within the business when it comes to operational change. And that's effectively what we're instigating here, is operational change, but in the third sector. Mm. And it comes well as well in terms of the project which we're working on with Cumberland Lodge and Justine Greening's Social Mobility Pledge, bringing them together with PTI, together with the SMBP, and also more recently the CBI, to look at how we, as a business community and as the third sector and as those from state, can collectively work more in a more effective manner to tackle the issue of social mobility. Now, that's a huge project, which is very ambitious. But again, the way and means in which we're structuring it has been helped immensely by Smart Lab. And I think it's, you know, without wanting to sound like a bloody advert, it's the way in which we're going to cut through the complexity to be able to peel back the layers to individual work streams, yeah, and see them in a visual manner, enables us to build the complexity. Because without the ability to visualise it separately, yeah, you can't build projects of this nature up. It's just nigh impossible because you get lost.
It's fascinating for me because our country has a history of doing this kind of thing way back to the Victorians. And, you know, you think about Sidney and Beatrice Webb and H.G. Wells, and our country has an amazing social history of how you create the future and how you create inclusivity. We seem to have forgotten that recently, but we're coming back to it, and it's sort of coming from within areas that may not have been there before. The thing that's fascinating to me, you know, you have the social map that's still at the London School of Economics, where, you know, they looked at the poverty map of London and saw how wealthy people were living right next to abject poverty when London was the gilded capital of the world, the height of empire. And that shocked so many people. It got a movement happening, which really started a social mobility movement in this country.
So the Booth study.
Yeah, the Booth study. Amazing. Absolutely incredible. Today, I mean, visualization, visual tools are still useful because we visualize and we, you know, move from a kind of fuzzy dream to something that's very specific as we bring it down into reality. The interesting thing is what we're able to do with digital these days. What does digital give us that we may not have been able to do before that we can tap into?
We have a great group of people who have come together that are really helping with this. And the digital side, I mentioned a minute ago about this sort of entry to work framework research program that's being looked at. And Barry's had a great idea as part of that, which is to utilise digital resources to create, I'll let you explain it because you'll do a better job than me, but to create a heat map of the UK, which is effectively the digital version of what you were talking about here.
Part of the thought leadership piece that we are doing in partnership with, as I said, Cumberland Lodge, the Social Mobility Pledge led by Justine Greening and the CBI, focuses on identifying how state, business and third sector can proactively collaborate to address the issues that mount a challenge to individuals from low socioeconomic backgrounds in terms of progressing through life and their careers. One of the things that we've noticed with the SMBP, we went from 20 students in London in 2014, we now deliver work experience placements with partners to over 500 in 2019. It's a franchise model. And when you get out to towns and cities, which are not the major conurbations in the UK, there's a challenge because you've got businesses spread left, right and centre. Students don't necessarily live conveniently within the city centre. Yeah. So there's lots of complexity to pulling that together. And as a consequence, there aren't as many opportunities for those students within those areas. So I think
just logistics you're talking about.
It's a lot.
A student might have to travel an hour or 2 hours.
Well, exactly. So, you know, a classic example being, you know, in terms of going by train from Hastings to Brighton will take you an hour and 20 minutes. Equally, if you're in the middle of Derbyshire trying to get into Sheffield, again, will take you an hour and 20 minutes. It kind of inhibits the ability for these students to engage with businesses.
Easily.
So,
and industrial parks are always on the outside and difficult to get to without cars.
I mean, there's lots of, you know, things which you wouldn't think about if you were simply engaging in delivering social mobility schemes in London, because everybody's conveniently aggregated from a business sense in 2 square miles. The students are used to travelling on the tube, and the tube exists, and it's a cheap form of transport. So when it comes to looking at issues for the UK, when it comes to social mobility or any social issue, you've got to have a UK-wide attitude, and you've got to go local, and you've got to deliver things through local organisations. But to enable you to do that, you need to be able to have things which you can replicate and scale quickly.
Toolkits.
In best practice, because ultimately the answer doesn't lie with organisations based in one city. Mm. They'll be based all around the UK, and it's about surfacing those and identifying how you can take the lessons, say, in the southwest and apply them into the northeast and vice versa. So the big piece of work that we'll be doing...
Without falling out over football.
Well, there is teams. That. Well, I mean, that's a really interesting point in terms of the SMBP about
please
identifying
do not
sports
start
teams.
On football teams.
You can take the boy out of the estate. So the heat map is born out of a piece of work that was done by the Social Mobility Commission and the DfE a few years back and identifying where social mobility cold spots existed.
And it's interesting because it is an online heat map, yes, isn't it, which is interactive in some way.
Absolutely. And there's a number of measures to identify whether or not something's a social mobility cold spot. From those cold spots, Justine, when she was Secretary of State for Education, identified a number of them to become opportunity areas. And that's where a huge amount of focus was placed in terms of assisting young people from low-income backgrounds and equally beyond education, those from those backgrounds progressing their careers. The map itself comes down to one thing and one thing alone, is being able to plot what business, what state and what third sector are doing to combat those issues that an individual faces. This will be something whereby you can plug into this digital map. You can identify the area you want to analyse. You can then plug into the various nodes that will appear there and you can get a summary of what those organisations are doing. And the key to it all is then articulating in a report what can those organisations do differently to make them more impactful. And then beyond that, what can we learn from those areas which can be translated and transported elsewhere in the country?
So what's been your experience when you've been speaking with businesses and perhaps, you know, people representing the state, but also other charities in the third sector? You know, are you perceived as sort of stepping on their toes or doing their work? What's been the reaction to how they've been involved?
This whole thing for me, I mean, just to summarise it very quickly, is all for me is about helping people create sort of accelerated paths to opportunity. And so collaboration is a massive part of that. And, you know, just to be frank and brutal, there isn't a lot of collaboration in and amongst charities. It's so bad the way it's set up in terms of, you know, you're given funding, then it's restricted, you can only use it for certain things. So a lot of charities are trying to find unrestricted funding. But then the balance is all wrong because they find then, let's say, for example, PTI comes in and gives them some unrestricted funding. If you get too much unrestricted funding, they take away your restricted funding. And it's crazy and it's a diminishing pot of money. And that's why there's no collaboration. And so if we can in some way help lower the amount of money people need by providing resources and aid and facilitate by providing a level of funding, it's to aid collaboration and communication.
And by resources, I'm hearing you say it's not just money, not just providing money, but to Barry's point earlier, what businesses and other organisations can provide is expertise.
Yeah.
Expertise, facilities, contacts, connections.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's so many. If you think about an organisation and all the things that are delivered to their employees in terms of training, in terms of resources, all of these resources. But it could be, you know, it could be online training development. It could be meeting rooms. It can be people that have incredibly, you know, very, very well qualified people. And again, I'm not taking away from the work that people do if they go out and do community work. But why have someone with qualifications in legal or accountancy painting a fence? You know, when frankly they can be doing legal and accountancy and dropping 20 grand off the bottom line requirement of a small charity.
Or mentoring a young person trying to get into that work.
I always think of, I think something you said both when we had a conversation, which I then had a conversation with a cab driver about how he was a cab driver, but before that, he'd been an artist, and he still thinks of himself as an artist. But he says when he didn't come from a wealthy or middle-class background, he came from a working-class background. And he said to become an artist was kind of counter to everything that he'd been brought up to know. And he remembers the first time he went into the Tate, and he said he was sweating, and it was a very stressful experience because galleries were for rich people, and he had to get over that. We then had a conversation about young people who don't come from middle-class backgrounds or who may not have had any access to a city office or an office of any sort or shopkeeping. You know, they've never had any experience going into those kinds of environments. And we forget that those kinds of experiences are things that empower young people and make them feel it's their right. And how do we enable that to happen so that people can move their way through society freely, unencumbered by the...
There's a huge value to that. you know, in terms of, you know, it's this unmeasured value where people think of everything in terms of a financial value, how much money can we get, which is fine. But, you know, there is a huge value to having a network and networks on networks that can provide access to offices and experiences and just generally leveling the playing field. Mm. Again, I mean, Barry's, you know, you're well placed to talk about this because this is something from your own, you know, background that we've spoken about quite a lot.
So the first office that I went into was the offices of Hogan Lovells on Holborn Viaduct when I was applying for my training contract. And it was incredibly daunting because I'd never ever been in an office. I mean, it was space age and computers on the desk. I mean, the only place of work that I'd been in is my dad, and he was a mechanic. You're on the back foot already. And it's one of the things which was one of the unintended benefits of the SMBP. The model was born out of necessity in the sense that we couldn't, as a group of lawyers within ITV, organise a week on our own or get the project management support from our internal support framework for legitimate reasons, because we were only a small number of people within a larger organisation. But the benefit of actually subdividing responsibility is that students got to go into five different organisations in the space of a week. And then slowly but surely you saw during the week that they became desensitised to their environment. Mm. You know, my daughter obviously my eldest daughter is now at university, has a very different view of the world than I had at her age. And I wouldn't even say she's arrogant or even entitled. What she is that's her norm. And that's the thing that differs from me and her, actually, in all honesty, is that she has this sense of belonging, because why wouldn't she feel a sense of belonging? Because that's been her world from the day one of her life. And so, you know, I think we need to level up. I don't believe that you replace one prejudice with another. I think at the end of the day, kids who go to private schools and public schools should be able to feel that they're not excluded from a meritocratic and fair society. They're definitely included. So this is about levelling up.
We used to talk about the glass ceiling. As you're going up and up in organisations, you reach a glass ceiling. Maybe we've created glass buildings now, which are creating the same the same thing for young people who are not familiar with that type of work and those types of organisations.
But I think one of the biggest issues that corporate Britain faces is the step-on point. I mean, I think in terms of assisting individuals from low-income backgrounds, or even working with other groups such as the veterans and the those individuals who are coming out of prison, there's a lot of people out there who want to do something to improve the fabric of society, to make it fairer, make it more inclusive and reintegrate people. Because I don't think we talk about rehabilitation anymore. I think, you know, it's about reintegration. It's about ensuring that we're having a grown-up conversation about the best means of ensuring that people don't commit offences, because the cost to the public purse is huge.
$14 billion, I think, was the last estimate.
How do you allow people meritocratically to come into a system which has very high standards and is expecting people to perform at those levels without it being a closed society?
Well, I think you start from the premise that we're not looking for a special favour. What we're trying to do is provide a balancing act in terms of ensuring that those people who aren't born with the feeling of belonging can have that substituted for experiences that we can create for them. Mm. And equally, it's about ensuring, you know, from an academic point of view, you know, I look at my children, we live in Kent. They don't go to selective schools in the sense that we're not paying fees, but the house prices in our area effectively close off the grammar schools in and around our area to those who are from low income. So effectively, they are quasi-private schools. So whatever we can do, and I accept that, you know, in a class size of 8 or 12 that my daughter finds herself in at A-level, whereas my A-level class was 33 for each of my 3 A-levels, it's going to be a different experience. Mm. And so you're trying to counterweight the differential in the academic experience and counterweight the social capital that an individual from, you know, my daughter's circumstances, to put them closer to the start line. You're not going to achieve par on par, I think. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a utopia you should strive for, but that's what you're trying to push for. That then actually those two individuals, irrespective of their starting point in life, can be fairly assessed based on their attributes and their ability, not on the lack of confidence they possess because they don't feel that they belong in our world, as it stands today, nor have they been inhibited through not having the same class of education.
It gives me so much hope I'm talking to you guys because, you know, I've said this to you before. I mean, the thing that really drew me to what you're doing is I started having the conversations again that I like to have and want to be a part of in this country. There's been so much negative press recently and the focus is so exclusive and racist and the rest of it. It's disheartening. Whereas this is about saying, let's turn that around because this is what we've done before and we're good at it. And there's no reason why this country should be exclusive and keep people down and out. It's not the way it works. It didn't make us great in the past.
There is a huge amount of goodwill in this country, and there's a huge amount of negative sentiment that's squashing it all at the moment. And there are a lot of people that really want to engage in something, but I think there's a fear of committing to charities on the basis that we all have families and jobs and we might let someone down. And there's also the simple situation that there isn't a kind of a plug-and-play vehicle where people can inject what they can inject, they can do it with a time commitment they can manage, and know that if they can't continue it for some reason, they're not letting anyone down. And that in itself is ultimately positive transformation and being able to say to people, here's a vehicle, we'll provide the projects, we'll bring resources, we'll bring funding, and we'll enable you to have an outlet for all of this kind of positive goodwill that you can engage in as and when you have the requirement to do so or the time.
It's at the start of the journey, Positive Transformation Initiative. It's going to be hopefully an amazing journey. As you progress in the next sort of 6-12 months, what are some of the things that you are looking to put in place and that maybe you need help with from people listening to this podcast?
This whole idea of people jumping on and investing their time. So working with Barry, people like SMBP, and helping look at the infrastructure that they've created and widen that out is one big part of what we're looking at. We've spoken a lot about bringing everyone together, business networks, bringing all, and there's a lot of people with some amazing, you know, titles and influence. But what we have to remember, and there was a lady who attended a forum recently who was one of the beneficiaries of a great charity called the School of Hard Knocks, who said to me, we need to make sure that we connect people who are ultimately going to benefit from this. We need to make sure that it's ground up as well. So we have a program, which I'll be able to talk about a bit more soon, where we're going to, you know, physically go out and visit a lot of the charities, prisons and schools, and, you know, physically make that connection so that it doesn't just become about, you know, people sitting behind emails. Yeah. And, you know, it's inclusive at all levels.
I've also met some incredibly talented media people involved in this initiative, and I know that they're documenting as you go and creating media assets. So the whole thing is communicating and starting to generate itself.
It is. I mean, we had an amazing meeting yesterday with a lady who has an incredible background. I mean, she really, in terms of resilience, I wouldn't do it justice to explain, but she's also, has had a career as a BBC news reporter, is looking, you know, to help us. But in terms of what we really need is conversations with businesses that are committed to change, individuals that want to make a positive impact, and really identify people that want accelerated paths to opportunity.
Barry, where do listeners find out more about Positive Transformation Initiative?
So you can find both myself and Dan on LinkedIn. But the digital home of PTI is with the Ludic Group. So info@ludicgroup.com. Ludic Group, all one word, is probably the best way to get to us.
We'll make sure that gets back to you. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Barry, for a fantastic, fascinating conversation. And you've been listening to this edition of Ludic Insights. Please remember to subscribe, and we look forward to your company next time.